The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Brianna Labuskas. She joins us on the telephone in Pennsylvania. She's got a new novel out. It's called The Boxcar Librarian. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Tell us how you got the idea for this story.
Well, I'm kind of a collector of interesting stories. I found The Boxcar Library, which was a real thing in the 1920s in Montana. I lived in Missoula for a couple months, and I was just visiting everything they had to offer, and this boxcar is preserved at Fort Missoula. So I went and I saw it, and I was like, that is such a cool thing that they went and they took these books to these lumberjacks and brought a little bit of light into this like very dark job at that time. And so I just kind of courted the idea, even before I was writing historical fiction. And then when I needed a new book idea, I came back to this. And I thought, I love this idea of books providing light. I have three historical fiction novels, and they all essentially are around that theme in different ways. They explore it in different ways. But they're all about the power of books to connect us with community. And I thought, this is the perfect story to explore that theme. And so that's kind of how I started with that kernel of the idea. And then I went kind of looking for different stories because I love weaving together stories. That's just how I love to write my books, is to weave together different stories. And I kind of started researching Montana during that time. And there's just no way you can read about Montana during that time and not read about the unions, the Copper Collar, the Copper Kings, and all of that. So I knew that was going to be a plot point. And then I also love the Federal One Project, which was this idea that government actually wanted to invest in art and literature and music and paintings. And so I looked into that project, and I found these guide series that were created to support writers during the Great Depression. And so it all kind of came together, and I was like, this is going to be the foundation for this story about books and writing and community. And it all just kind of like fit together after that.
This was a project during the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as we were in that Great Depression. Did I detect a slight note of irony when you referred to it?
Yes, because I think it was, it feels like so much of attention can go, the first thing that goes, right, when you're in like a hard times, it kind of feels like cuts can be made to humanities or these extraneous things that are looked at as maybe extraneous, but they're not. They're so much a part of our society. They're so important to us as humans to be able to tell each other stories, to support art, to be able to preserve what makes us human. And I think a lot of times, you know, when you're looking at austerity measures, it's going to be what gets cut. And so it felt very cool to me to look back and see this moment of time where there was so much support poured into these programs. And their footprint has lasted to this day. I mean, we see the murals, but we also have literature books that are classics that were created through this program. We have tons of folklore recordings from former slaves telling their own stories and their own voices. That was all through this program. Just so much history was preserved, and culture was created through just giving a little bit of support to the arts and humanities.
Yes, we got rural electrification. I don't think they're going to take that away. We got Social Security, which the last time I checked, we still have. My guest is Brianna Labuskas. Her book is The Boxcar Librarian. What turned you into an evangelist for books? I know there's a story here.
I have always loved books. I was just one of those kids that was like on road trips. I was in the back of the car with my book in hand. So when it's an interest, you kind of go digging, and it's, you know, you start reading stories about how much empathy it can create. You see the way your own world expands. You understand how books can connect you to other people. I have a passage in the book that really kind of is a thesis statement for like my life, which is essentially, if you read the same book as somebody else, like there is a thread there. It might be very small, but it is a connection. And I think, you know, our society thrives when we're more connected to each other and we understand each other's stories. It allows our own worldview to expand and welcome in other people and understand their life and everything like that. And I think books in particular have a very unique way of putting you into somebody else's head. So like movies, you can kind of see them acting and you can see them going through the script, et cetera, but you're not actually in their head usually, unless there's a voiceover. But for books, you're actually like experiencing that other people have very rich internal lives. And so for me, it's just always something that is so important for us and our society to be healthy and happy and productive.
I thought that's why we have Instagram. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
My guess is Brianna Labuskas, the Boxcar Librarian, her new novel. Okay, set this up. You've already alluded to the fact that you like to tie these different story threads together, and you've got different timelines going here. But we know there's going to be a convergence of these characters. We just feel it. We understand the way that you're setting this up. Explain what the story is about.
So, like I said, there's three different timelines. And so you have Alice Munro, who is based on a real librarian. I personally don't love, you know, putting fake thoughts into real people's heads. So I didn't want to base it. I didn't actually want to use the real character. But she's inspired by this young woman in Missoula in 1920s who came up with this idea for the Boxcar Library. She was an evangelist for it. And she really made it happen. And so that's kind of a driving plot point. And in the background, you have Colette, who is the daughter of a union organizer. And you see her grow up with her father organizing unions. And then he dies, which I don't think is a spoiler. It's kind of her driving purpose. And so she's trying to find the people who killed him. She knows that who's responsible, which is, you know, the Copper Kings who are running this entire state. But she really wants to find out who exactly is responsible. And then you have those two storylines collide because Colette eventually becomes the librarian for this boxcar. And then we have Millie, who's in the future. She's working on American Guide series book for Montana. And she kind of uncovers this mystery where Alice and Colette leave on their inaugural journey of this boxcar and only Alice comes back and she wants to figure out what happens. So she's kind of digging into their mystery there. And then they all kind of collide. Their stories collide in like the mystery aspect of this book.
Please explain the concept of the Boxcar Library. How did it work? What was it about? Where did it go? What did it do?
Yeah. Alice, who is based on this woman named Ruth, she was a wealthy woman in Missoula, and she went to one of her father's friends and said, I really want to bring books to the lumberjacks who are out in, and think like Montana, 1920. So like thick forests, very little connection to any kind of other people other than the people at the camps. And they were all just set up all through like northern, western Montana. And the thing that connected them were railroads. And so the companies, the lumber companies, the coal companies had to get the trees back to process them. And so all these camps were set up and they were all connected by railroad. And so this young librarian went to one of the rich owners and said, will you just build a boxcar. Like, it will you don't have to go out of your way at all. It will just connect to your train. You have to go there anyway. And then it can bring books to these men who, a lot of them didn't have their wives. A lot of them didn't have their families. It was just them. And they had to, you know, they're surviving through Montana's winters, which are very cold. And so she's just like, I just want to bring them a little bit of light. And he was like, no one is going to read these books. He said, like, I don't think anyone's going to read them. But because you're my friend's daughter, I'm going to indulge you. And so he built a boxcar. There were, I kind of mashed up a little bit of the timeline. He let the, it was the original lending library for the workers was out of the hotel, and it became very popular. So then he let it go into the boxcar. But it was incredibly successful. There were thousands of books checked out within the first year. The workers started putting money in themselves to get new books and to keep the stock up and high and running. And it just, it lasted for about 10 years until the Great Depression, obviously, and that kind of derailed it a little bit, no pun intended. And so, but yeah, so it was incredibly successful. Like, it blew away all expectations. And these men were just so hungry for these books. And it wasn't just, there was fiction, there was also nonfiction, like ways that they could improve to, some people, you know, wanted to study for college or, you know, better their, you know, create a small business or what have you. And they had these books that helped them do that. They also just had magazines and newspapers that could connect them to the outside world, which I think was really appreciated too. And even there was like music. They had a like a record player in there too. And it just became a gathering place at these camps whenever it would set up. It set up for about 2 weeks at each camp. And then they could come and bring the books that they checked out the last time back, or they could just hang out and read books. And it became like a really like a community gathering spot for these men who were living pretty hard lives at the time.
It was the Boxmobile. My guest is Brianna Labuskas. Her book is The Boxcar Librarian. You're listening to The Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. We need to take a quick break, and we'll continue our conversation with Brianna right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I'm joined on the telephone by Brianna Labuskas, and we're talking about her new novel, The Boxcar Librarian. You already mentioned that Colette's father gets murdered, and a big part of the story is that she's trying to track down his killer, and she's pretty tough. And we also have the timeline. You just set it up there. We're 100 years ago for these boxcar libraries in the mid-1920s. And we also have a lot of union activity. Colette's dad was involved with these union organizers. And I won't neglect to mention the romantic elements in here. We've got Colette, who's got a crush on this Wobbly, this International Workers of the World infiltrator type guy. We've got Alice, who has a couple of love interests in this one, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the love that's going on in here and the smoldering passion.
Yeah. I really love, or like to think about during this time, the men who came back from World War One. And so Alice's love interest is Sydney Walker, and he's not what she expected from men who came back from World War One. She expected them to be, you know, all devastated and sad, and he reacted in a different way, which I also think was important to show that people just react to these big traumatic experiences very differently. And you can't judge what someone is going through just from their, what their actions are. And so it really challenged her as a character to more broadly expand her worldview. She's very sheltered. She does live in Montana, but she's wealthy. So she's sheltered a little bit from all of the hardships there. And so I think that he's also wealthy, but he kind of went through this really terrible experience. Everyone coming home from World War One is just, you know, it impacted that generation so much. I think, you know, Lord of the Rings is such a good book to read if anyone wants to think about that. So, yes, it was like romance, but it was also kind of this deeper connecting to someone you never thought you were going to kind of connect to by understanding all that they've been through. She also had another love interest, Mac, but he was always her father's left-hand man and or right-hand man. I get that phrase wrong. and she kind of, that kind of creates a tension between them where she never thinks, she doesn't know if he'll ever see her as, you know, an adult or a fully of her own person rather than just trying to please her father. And then Colette, yeah, Colette has her wobbly. I obviously wanted to write about the passion and just fire of like a natural born rebel. The people who would be at the barricades in Les Mis. I think that is a very unique personality and I like exploring it, especially in different eras. Like, what does that look like in World War II? What does it look like when fighting the unions? What does that look like in the French Revolution? I think there is that personality that I just find very interesting, and kind of complex in its own way. So I have, if you'll note, you'll notice that character show up a couple times, like throughout my, historical fiction, just because I think it's, a personality type that I like to delve into.
It sounds like you were just alluding to some of your other books. My guest is Brianna Labuscus, and her new one is The Boxcar Librarian. And yeah, Sidney, he comes from some money. He drives a $7,000 car in 1924. That's like a super Tesla or something. I mean, yeah. That's just super expensive. And I think one of my favorite scenes in the book is when she, and this isn't a spoiler to say this, I don't think. She sneaks into the back seat of his Packard, and he drives off, and he's headed over to this place outside of Missoula where they gamble and they carry on, and there's a lot of sort of tawdry activity going on. And the thing that really tickled me about this setting was that every year I interview an author who lives on a ranch outside of Lolo, Montana, and I had never heard of this activity going on. I'm assuming this is historically based. It really was sort of a den of iniquity 100 years ago.
Yes. So when I was there, when I lived in Missoula for a couple months, I watched A River Runs Through It based on a fabulous short story. And the main character, I don't know if you've read it, but the brother is kind of a ne'er-do-well. And he's always in Lolo, and there's these bars like that are out of houses and drinking and gambling and stuff. And so when I was there, we would see signs for Lolo everywhere because it's right outside Missoula. And so I had to go visit and look into it. And it was just kind of the fun center, or the fun outskirts of the more respectable Missoula.
Were these signs you were seeing just road signs, or were they advertising something?
Just road signs.
Okay.
So I watched the movie, and then I kept seeing it everywhere. I was like, what is up? Is this real? Like, Lolo is a place? Because I wasn't sure, because the short story is fictional, but it's kind of based on the writer's life. And so I wanted to go check it out.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so... It's a good movie if you want to see more about Lolo.
James Lee Burke lives out there.
Okay.
Yeah, he has a ranch out there by Lolo.
It's beautiful land. I was so happy to write about Montana. I stayed in Glacier National Park for a few months as well. So to be able to add those details to the book was just phenomenal.
If you're just tuning in, it's The Book Nook. My guest is Brianna Labuscus. Her new one is The Boxcar Librarian. Tell us about some of your other work. What other stuff have you written?
So I've been mentioning I have two historical fiction novels before this one. They're both World War II, sort of, but they kind of span the 30s to the 50s, about 20 years, because I'm very interested in what led up to World War II and the aftermath. So the first one is Librarian of Burned Books. There is a storyline that focuses on, you know, Berlin in 1933 when the books were burned. But even that 5 month period before the books burned, a lot happened. I would highly recommend either, I mean, I recommend reading my books, but I also recommend looking into that period. It's very enlightening. And so I love that period. So I wanted to write about someone, American one, who went over there and had their opinions changed during that time. And it ends with the burning of the books. And the other two storylines involve these libraries that popped up to protect the books that were being targeted by the Nazis. They popped up kind of independently from each other, and in Paris and Brooklyn. And so that became a storyline. And then the third storyline, I do like three storylines, is the Armed Services Editions, which were small paperback books that were sent to soldiers during World War II to bring a little light into their lives, if you can notice a theme. And then The Lost Book of Bonn is about the recovery efforts for books. So we hear a lot about the paintings trying to get back to the original owners after World War II. But they also did that with books. So the Nazis hoarded all of these books. They were like public research books, libraries, private collections, and there's just millions of books stashed away all over Europe. And so they went into this warehouse where librarians from all over the world helped to return them to the rightful owners, essentially. And I had a fictional librarian go over and find a book and then try to trace it back to see what happened to the owners during World War II. So those are my two historical fiction. I also write thrillers, psychological thrillers. And people often say, you know, that's quite a big gap between historical fiction and thrillers. But I actually think they're pretty similar because they deal with, you know, heightened emotions, like the extremes of humanity. You either have like a serial killer or a megalomaniac dictator. and you have fear and love and everything is heightened. The stakes are heightened. And so I have found I like writing in that environment, not more than necessarily this slice of life space.
A megalomaniac dictator. Interesting. you write in your author's note, and I was very inspired by this. You wrote, "I strongly believe one of the best ways to fight fascism, hatred, and bigotry is by getting to know the people who are scapegoated, who are different than us, who live in a different state, pray to a different God, eat different food, listen to different music, love different books." I love that. That is so, so beautiful that you said that.
Thank you. Like that felt I was very optimistic when I wrote that. But something that just connected for me with the American Guide series was this idea that, and this is the books that were funded by the government to employ writers during the Great Depression. So they had American Guide series for each state, and so it employed an office worth of writers. And, you know, they weren't perfect, but their intention was to introduce America to Americans and to introduce all of us to each other. And they tried really hard to actually find different voices than the ones that everybody was reading in the newspapers that time, or that was on the radio or taking up national attention. They found, you know, like workers in Montana, but they also found former slaves, and they talked to Native Americans, and they talked to women, which I thought was really cool. They emphasized talking to women and listening to the voices, their stories, and highlighting them. And so it kind of sounds so silly to say these travel books, these travel guides that had, you know, motel rates or whatever, was kind of what I see as the best of us, which is highlighting everyone's stories that live in this country and how our diversity and how having different people here and who have different lives and different world experiences actually makes America stronger and better. And I think that those guides for me was such like a light bulb switch when I found out about them, because I thought, you know, that is the thread that runs through the whole story, which is community, which is other people's stories help us create better communities. Which you can see with the train, you know, the books and all these people learning other people's lives than theirs and connecting to that. And then the guide series and then unions, just having more people together, you're going to be able to fight, you know, the bigger evil when you connect with people and create a community together. So for me, it was that sentence to me was what I wanted the book to be about. And the storylines from the past were able to add and layer into it, which was really cool.
Well, community is so important, and that's what we're into here on Public Radio, serving our community. That's what our underwriters on this program are into, serving their community, all the libraries that sponsor this program. And it's been so fun talking to you about The Boxcar Librarian, your new novel, Brianna. And before we let you go, you mentioned that you have these twin literary passions, writing historical fiction and writing thrillers. And I'm guessing that you read an awful lot of books. And I'm wondering, who are the names? What are some of the writers in those two genres that you admire?
Oh, how much time do you have? No, just kidding. I love Kate Quinn for historical fiction. Maggie Shipstead. She wrote The Great Circle, which is just a phenomenal book, also set a little bit in Montana. Megan Abbott for thrillers. I love her style. She writes so much like in the body, which is, I always just want to study her language. Mm. S.A. Cosby, who is doing amazing things in Southern noir. Madeline Martin, who shares my love of books. So she has a bunch of books about books, which is just, you know, right up my alley. Elise Hooper, who writes in the 30s as well. So just endless amounts of people who I just love reading.
So many great books out there. We've had Megan Abbott and S.A. Cosby on the program, and they wrote.
Oh my gosh, I love both of them.
They really are great. And S.A.'s got a new book coming out, and I've got an advanced copy of it. Pretty exciting.
Oh, you are lucky.
Yeah, well, I begged. I said,
I'm sure.
You know,
it's a hot commodity.
Well, I noticed he posted a photo of it on Twitter. And I'm like, okay, there's advanced copies out there. So I tracked a copy down, and I just got it. I'm excited about reading it.
Oh, amazing. That's so exciting. Yeah, it's definitely the day it comes out will be on my bookshelf.
Well, Brianna, it's been a pleasure talking to you about your book. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really nice.
My guest has been Brianna Labuskas, and that is a Lithuanian name, by the way, like McCunis. And we've been having a fun time before we went on the air talking about our Lithuanian ancestry. Her new one is The Boxcar Librarian, inspired by true events. And you heard about it on the Book Nook on your public radio station, WYSO. And you can listen to over 1,100 archived interviews anytime you want on our website at WYSO.org. Don't touch that dial. We've got a little extra time on the program this morning. We're going to bring you a bonus segment of the Book Nook right after this. It's your bonus segment on WYSO, the Book Nook. And if you were listening a couple of weeks ago at this time on Saturday, you were a very devoted listener because it was our spring membership campaign. I was on the air with Luke Dennis live in studio. I do that just a couple of times a year in the spring and the fall. The rest of the time we pre-record the program because there aren't a whole lot of authors who are awake at 7 o'clock in the morning to do live interviews. So it's very convenient for us to tape them. We are taping this interview right now as I speak, and Luke and I were talking, and we played some excerpts from interviews 2 weeks ago, And one of the interviews that I featured was one that I recorded almost 10 years ago with a guy named Harvey Kay. His only appearance on the program, Harvey had written a book about a speech given by Franklin Delano Roosevelt on January 6th, 1941. And they call it his Four Freedoms speech. And as I was talking to Brianna about her book and the New Deal and all the things that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did during his administration to try to extricate this country from the Great Depression, programs like Social Security, rural electrification, the WPA, all these programs. And right now we're seeing the shredding of Roosevelt's safety net. And I got a lot of comments over the last 2 weeks from people who heard this excerpt. People wanted to know, what is that book? Who is that author? It really piqued some interest. So we're going to bring you another excerpt from that interview with Harvey Kay talking about FDR's Four Freedoms. We call it the best of the book nook. Harvey Kay joins us. His book is The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. The book just came out in paperback. I think that one that is at the forefront right now, as we see so much money being concentrated in the pockets of the few, and so many people who are just barely making it, is freedom from want. Let's talk about this one. Let's talk about the minimum wage.
You know, that's a good point. During the 1930s, when Roosevelt in 1933 signed into law the National Industrial Recovery Act, which is a major effort to try to create some kind of cooperative a labor system between capital, between business and workers, he signed, when he did the signing, which included a minimum wage component, he said no company should be allowed to exist in the United States that did not pay a living wage. So in his mind, and in many of his, you know, allies in the labor movement, as they saw it, the minimum wage was meant to be the beginnings of pursuing and creating a living wage. And then in 1938, when the Democrats passed the Fair Labor Standards Act that made the minimum wage fundamental to the American economy, once again he made remarks about the imperative of thinking in terms of a living wage. Well, we know very well that the minimum wage continually falls behind. It's barely, you know, nobody can buy food, cover, you know, shelter, and put a shirt on their back on the minimum wage. I mean, and we also well know that the fight for the 15, you know, the fight for at least 15, which is the move towards a living wage, that's probably the most energized political action of our day. And it's rooted, I have to remind everyone, it's rooted back in that 1930s vision that the minimum wage was meant to lead to the living wage.
I see this as an issue that is very crucial on both sides of the aisle. I mean, I talk to people a lot who I consider to be progressive, liberal people who run businesses. And when you bring up the fact that people should be paid a living wage, sometimes they just go strangely silent. I don't understand
I don't understand it either. I mean, one could argue for it on simply moral grounds, you know, all these folks who talk about America being a Judeo-Christian nation. But it's also the case that this is a society that prides itself on freedom, equality, and democracy. And as Roosevelt said a number of times, and most significantly in 1944 when he proposed an economic bill of rights to put the Four Freedoms, you know, basically on the agenda as in a constitutional way, he said, necessitous men are not free men. In other words, necessitous people in need are not free people. So if we're going to pride ourselves on this question of freedom, then we ought to make sure that Americans can participate in a free fashion and not be subject to the slavery of want.
Harvey, in your book, you give us a report card, in a way, on the various presidents that have followed Franklin Delano Roosevelt and how they have scored as far as adjusting themselves to the concept of the Four Freedoms and whether they cared or not. And it's interesting to read your take on this. President Obama doesn't score very well on your report card, does he?
No, definitely not. I mean, let's put it this way. I don't doubt for a moment that Obama would publicly subscribe to the Four Freedoms if he had to. I don't deny that. And I don't. I also believe that in his heart of hearts, he's probably got, as Lincoln said, the better angels of our nature in his mind. But here's the thing. One of the things about Roosevelt that made him so great is that he didn't just offer a vision. Over and over again in his presidency, and he was elected president four times with good reason, over and over again in his presidency, he understood that a great president is not somebody who just says, I'm going to fight for you. He understood that it's somebody who would encourage the fight in Americans. So his administration basically called on workers to organize. His administration, by way of the of people in the Department of Agriculture, actually called on housewives of the 1930s to organize as consumers, and they did indeed launch a significant movement known as the Housewives Movement of the 30s. So if you think about Obama, I mean, he had fine rhetoric when he ran for office, but he never grasped, and I think probably never wanted to grasp the fact that if he really did believe, yes, we can, it was not for him to turn his back on young people and on working people and negotiate with a few Republicans in Congress when he was pursuing Obamacare. His task would have been not only to do that, but to tell Trumka to bring out the troops of the AFL-CIO into the public square. Hell, that might have kept the public square free of the Tea Party.
Hmm. The speech he gave in 1941 where he talked about the Four Freedoms is obviously the linchpin of your whole book. But there's another speech that you refer to as the most radical speech ever given by an American president, and Roosevelt gave it. And when I read your excerpt from it, it just gave me chills.
Yeah, the 1936 Democratic Convention acceptance speech, where he had been leading up to this. This was June, July 1936 in Philadelphia. And he had in mind this moment as a kind of renewal of the American Revolution. And he compares the corporate interests of the day, especially what he himself, by the way, referred to as the 1% when he was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the Wilson administration. He talked about the 99 and the 1%. And basically what he said is, look, the 1% are not unlike the aristocrats of England and colonial America. They're economic royalists. And just as Americans had to overthrow the economic royalists of those days, so too must we perhaps overthrow the structure of power by which they gain their wealth and hold on to the mechanisms of control in this country. And he was pretty blunt about it. I mean, he said, you know, they complain about that when they were trying to, overturn America. It's not that we're going to overturn America. It's that we find it necessary to overturn the power of economic royalists. I mean, how many presidents do you know actually call on Americans to mobilize and really do challenge not just the status quo, but challenge the very power structure that exists in the country? I mean, we all knew that Roosevelt was a reformer. Too often we limited his reforms to trying to save capitalism. I come to see him as a real radical. I think he, in many ways, the most radical of our presidents, and that speech was the most radical of his administration. Maybe not the most visionary. The Four Freedoms and Second Bill of Rights speech may have been more visionary kinds of speeches, but that was the most radical.
And as I read the list of things enumerated on the Second Bill of Rights, I have to think, gosh, if all Americans had these, we would be a very happy place.
And as since I know you've read the book, you'll know that 85% of Americans endorsed the fundamentals of the economic Bill of Rights. They said they wanted universal national health care. They wanted to guarantee educational opportunities for everyone, which basically meant provide aid for students to stay in high school and go to college. They wanted to guarantee basically that there would not be want and fear in America. Now, they never got it. They got close to it with the GI Bill of Rights, but even the GI Bill of Rights had to be fought for, and it became the greatest public welfare program in America and helped make the United States all the more equal, all the richer, all the more prosperous, and all the stronger in the post-war years.
Yeah, I don't hear anybody say anything bad about the GI Bill, even today.
Right. Nobody knocks the GI Bill of Rights. And don't forget, 16 million Americans served during World War II, 350,000 of them women. So if you think about it, look, almost a half a million didn't come home, but one out of every, I think the number, if there were 130 million Americans at the time, what we've, and 12 million Americans participated in the GI Bill, almost one out of every eight times my math is off, or one out of every 10 is basically a recipient of the GI Bill benefits. That's a significant number of people. And if you think about it in terms of a generation, that's almost a whole generation that's benefiting from the greatest public welfare program in American history. And nobody complains about it today.
Wow.
Think about what we could do with that kind of commitment today.
And that was Harvey Kaye talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Four Freedoms. He appeared on the program 10 years ago. And that was our bonus segment, Best of the Book Nook, coming your way. And tomorrow, we'll bring you the Book Nook again. In case you weren't aware of it, the show comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 and every Sunday morning at 10:30. And they're entirely different programs. Do you ever wish that you could go back in time? Well, tomorrow on the program, we're going to do that. We're going to go back to the year 1980. I'll be featuring an interview with the co-author of a book called Stealing Time. Her name is Telia Klebanov-Jacobs. And this is really a fun story. It's a story of a 15-year-old girl who one day is in her bedroom in her apartment in New York City, and she's suddenly back in 1980, long before she was born. And in 1980, the bedroom that she is currently in the year 2020 was her father's bedroom. And as she realizes she's going through some kind of a weird experience, a boy is standing there in the bedroom saying, "What are you doing in my bedroom?" And it doesn't take her long to figure out that she's encountering her own father as an adolescent. And after that, the fun begins. And I want to bring you the very beginning of this story to kind of show how they set this up. Chapter 1, New York City, Monday, March 16th, 2020. Tori had no way of knowing that the diamond would finish her story, a story begun before she was born. Through the open door of the study, she heard the click of the keyboard. Her mom, Adina, was securing a rental car for the two of them to drive to Newton, Massachusetts, where they would ride out the pandemic with Adina's sister, Simone. Yep, right from one pandemic epicenter to another, Boston's numbers were almost as bad as New York's, typical, thought Tori. Her folks were such overachievers. Well, Adina was. Law partner, degrees from Wellesley and Yale, all that. Her dad, Bob, did meh-level cybersecurity, a position he had acquired by going to night school and earning a certificate in advanced Surly. You never know what might set him off. Once, years earlier, while visiting Aunt Simone, they had driven past a white dome building with columns. Tori, who was 5 at the time, had said, "Look, Daddy, it's Washington." But Bob had said, "No, that's MIT. I got in there." And then he glowered at the road, hands tight on the wheel, leaving her wondering, what's she done wrong this time? Classic. Forget about it, Tori told herself. Right now, she had other things on her mind. Specifically, her parents' impending divorce and the coronavirus that had New York and the entire world surfing on waves of terror. Looking out her apartment window at the incongruously bright spring weather, she could almost feel every school shutting and every flight grounding. Could almost hear 8 million people panic shopping for toilet paper and clawing the backs of frozen food shelves for every last leaky bag of peas as every damn door in every building in the city slammed and double-latched shut. How thoughtful of her parents to choose this time to separate. "Are you packed?" said Adina from the doorway. Tori gave her mother the side eye. "Almost. Well, finish up. We can't delay." Tori stared at the empty streets, which ordinarily have been draped in shamrock bunting for the St. Patrick's Day parade. Not this year, I don't think traffic will be much of a problem. They might close state borders. Tori slouched onto the sofa, tucking her shock of purple hair behind one ear. You should wear a mask. Masks are for sick people, Adina yanked on her coat. Her eyes were wide and the skin of her face looked tight. Even New Yorkers with their been there, done that attitude weren't prepared for this. Dad says to wear gloves. Tori's phone pinged and she pulled out of her pocket. The battery was low. Your dad's not an expert. Neither are you. Tori hated herself, but at that moment, she hated her mother even more. Gloves are for first responders. Tori put her sneakers on the sofa because it was a reliable way to make her parents angry. Wow, Mom, so cool you listen to NPR. She heard the hiss of Adina exhaling through her teeth. Be ready to go when I get back. The door banged behind her. It was probably the only one in the building that wasn't welded shut. Making a face, Tori opened her phone. The ping was a reminder from Barclays Center that the March 21st game was canceled. Celtics versus Nets. Adina had gotten comps at work, center court seats, and Tori had been looking forward to it for weeks. Thanks for the memo, guys. As if she needed anyone to jog her memory about the fact that the world was ending. She deleted the notification and skimmed through her messages, hoping she'd missed something earlier. Unlike Barclays Center, her friends weren't texting or even answering her messages. What were they so busy with? They weren't going in exile like she was. Tori! Tori jerked her head up. Her father stood in the doorway, shoulders sagging, heavy brows creased, graying hair rumpled as if he'd been pulling at it. Not for the first time, Tori felt a prickle of irritation at his perennially sad eyes and jowly frown. When he wasn't angry, he looked like a bereaved bulldog. What? He crossed the room, proffering a crumpled ball of latex-free gloves. Take these. She jammed them into the pocket of her jeans and went back to her phone, thinking, you can leave now. Bob rubbed his ear. You can visit any time, he said softly. She swung her legs off the sofa and stomped past him. Yeah, right. In a few hours, she would be in Massachusetts, land of Boston accents, inferior bagels, lousy pizza, and having to be driven everywhere. She and Adina would flatten the coronavirus curve by staying with Aunt Simone and Poppy, the cat Tori was allergic to, and Simone's two young kids. Tori would definitely have to babysit, even though Adina kept saying she wouldn't. Meanwhile, Bob would stay here, supposedly helping take care of his mother, who lived nearby in a home for the decrepit. Grandma Louise had a beautiful smile, but could only breathe with an oxygen tube up her nose. Between wheezes, she would always be talking about my Victor, who Tori was named after and who had been dead since before Tori was born. Once when she was little, Bob had showed her the storefront where Victor had worked selling baseball cards and vintage comic books. Now it was a pawn shop squeezed between a juice bar and a Thai restaurant near Madison Square Garden. Tori had lived in New York all her life, well, except for summer camp, but all those kids were from the city too, so it was like New York with mosquitoes. She had grown up in this apartment. Hell, her father had grown up in this apartment, and now it would never be home again thanks to him. His morose silences, his anger that flared and died for no apparent reason, the diamond-hard walls he put up around himself, Adina had stood it as long as she could. Tori slammed the door to her room and looked around for a charger. The place was a mess. The detritus of her life clumped like trash during a garbage strike. One pile was her school books for Columbia grammar and prep. Most of the neighborhood kids went to PS 142, which was walking distance instead of two subways away, but Bob had gone to CGP and insisted she do the same. Now she'd never go back there. She shoved the books aside, hoping they were hiding a charger. They weren't. And that is the opening. She's about ready to time travel to 1980 and meet her own father as a teenager. And this is quite a story. It's called Stealing Time by Telia Klebanov-Jacobs and Norman Birdenbach. And I'll be joined tomorrow morning at 10:30 by Telia. And we're going to talk about this wonderful time travel novel that they co-wrote together. That's right here in the Book Nook on WYSO, your public radio station.